Good morning. I'm Joy Cardine. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. It's coming up on 10 minutes past 7 o'clock on this Friday, April the 27th. For the first time ever, Japanese automaker Toyota sold more vehicles worldwide in the first 3 months of this year than General Motors. Toyota dealers moved 2.35 million vehicles compared to GM's 2.6 million. So, how significant is it that Toyota surpassed GM? Why did this happen, and will Toyota stay in the driver's seat when it comes to worldwide sales? Is GM's loss of the world's largest title an omen of tougher times ahead for the American auto industry? And are you among those who drive a Toyota, or do you drive a GM? Let us know why and your questions for our guest, who is a New York Times reporter based in Detroit who writes about the automobile industry. 1-800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234. That's toll-free from anywhere. If you're in Madison, 263-1890, 263-1890, or send us an email to talk@wpr.org. Please include your first name and your community with your email. And let me correct my figures here. Toyota dealers report selling 2.35 million vehicles compared to 2.26 million for General Motors. Kind of skipped over a digit there. Our guest is Micheline Maynard. She is the Detroit Bureau Chief for the New York Times. She's also a lecturer on the global auto industry at the University of Michigan and author of a number of books on the auto industry. Most recently, The End of Detroit, How the Big Three Lost Their Grip on the American Car Market. Good morning.
Good morning. It's nice to be with you.
Thank you so much for being with us. I understand that you saw this coming, Toyota eclipsing GM. And wrote about that in your book.
Right. I actually spent some time in Japan about 4 years ago. And while I was there, Toyota issued its plan for 2010. And I was looking at the numbers, and I realized that if Toyota achieved its goals, it would be larger than General Motors. Well, when I wrote that, nobody was aware of this plan for 2010. And people were saying, oh, no, it isn't possible. General Motors will always be largest. And look, you know, Toyota only has a few plants in the United States. How could they possibly become the world's largest car maker? Well, Toyota just broke ground on their eighth assembly plant in North America. They've picked up a number of sales in Europe, in China, and other parts of the world, and here they are ahead of General Motors by a very slim margin.
Yeah. So why did those who think that GM was going to stay in this top spot all this time?
Well, I think a couple of things. First of all, you know, General Motors is sort of on a perpetual restructuring, mm-hmm. and every few years they introduce a new line of vehicles, and they say that these are the vehicles that will halt our market share decline, and instead their market share decline continues. And I think there has been a belief inside GM that, you know, they will always be number one and that no one else had the ability to pass them.
Oh, so how's GM taking this news?
Well, you get kind of a mixed reaction from GM. I mean, on one hand, sort of one line is size doesn't matter. What really matters is our restructuring, and we want to be profitable again. And then on the other hand, their CEO has said, we'll fight for every sale, and we like being number one. So I think that honestly reflects kind of a divide within General Motors over the meaning of this.
Yeah, and how is Toyota receiving the news?
Well, Toyota has a reputation as being a very humble company, at least their public reputation, and they basically say the title doesn't mean anything to us. We want to get happy customers, one customer at a time. I think actually they don't like the attention that they've gotten as a result of this. I think they would rather operate a little bit under the radar.
Yeah. What is it? Why did Toyota surpass GM? Is there a single factor as to why this happened?
Well, no. I mean, it's a collection of things, but I think what is with Toyota is they're not a terribly flashy company. They're not a terribly aggressive company, but they're steady and they're relentless and they don't really lose customers. There are certainly people in your audience that would, you know, maybe have had a bad experience with a Toyota, but by and large, people who buy Toyotas tend to buy another Toyota. They don't they don't lose their buyers, and then their buyers act as ambassadors for the brand. And, you know, it isn't for everybody. Some people think Toyotas are too vanilla-flavored and too bland, but I will say that, you know, once you start buying them, you get hooked on the quality, and then you don't want to take a chance on anything else.
Yeah. Well, in the spirit of full disclosure, I am on my third Toyota, and that's I don't buy a new car every two years or anything. I keep them for about 10 years each, and that's why I'm on my third Toyota.
Well, that's interesting to hear. My brother was the first person in our family to buy a Toyota back in the 70s, and actually learned to drive a stick shift on his Toyota, and my family had been General Motors owners until that point, and now, you know, I have a Lexus. My brother has two Toyotas. My mom has a Lexus. And it is true. You know, once one person buys one, it pulls other people in.
Yeah. I thought maybe the Prius sales might be also helping Toyota right now.
Prius is actually, I think, the third best-selling Toyota in the United States. And, in fact, they hope to double their Prius sales this year. Prius has been an enormous public relations tool for Toyota because they decided more than 10 years ago that they wanted to get into the hybrid electric market. Now, there's a lot of debate about hybrids. Are they worth the money? Do you really save on gasoline costs? We don't know about the technology, but, you know, they did it, and they were really first to get into that market in a very heavy fashion. Honda actually beat them to the market, but they had a car called the Insight that I always thought looked like an upside-down bathtub on wheels, where the Prius was a little bit more like a car that we were familiar with.
We're talking with Micheline Maynard, the Detroit bureau chief for the New York Times, talking with her about the news this week that Toyota has surpassed GM in terms of worldwide auto sales, beating GM for the very first time. We're wondering how important this milestone is and welcoming your questions and thoughts for our guest. Our lines are full already, but you can call in when someone hangs up at 1-800-642-1234 in Madison 263-1890. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network. This is the Ideas Network. I'm Joy Cardine. It's 18 minutes past 7 o'clock on this Friday, April the 27th. Hoping you'll join Ben Marins this afternoon between 4 and 6. At Issue with Ben Marins after 4, it's Your Views on the News. Ben will have a guest, and you can talk about the Iraq vote in Congress or the record-high stock market or other top stories from the news this week. We're talking about one of the top stories in the news this week, the news that Toyota, for the first time ever, beat GM in worldwide car sales. And we are welcoming your thoughts and questions for our guest, who is the Detroit bureau chief for the New York Times, a lecturer on the global auto industry at the University of Michigan, the author of a number of books on the auto industry, her most recent, The End of Detroit, How the Big Three Lost Their Grip on the American Car Market. And before we go to the phones, Ms. Maynard, let me ask you just how serious this is in terms of the American auto industry. How bad an omen is this that Toyota has taken the number one spot?
Well, I don't know why you're viewing it as a bad omen. I mean, I don't know what it means in a negative way for the American economy. I mean, if you look at the amount of money that Toyota is spending in places like Indiana, Tennessee, Mississippi, Texas, people there think this is a great omen. I was just in Lafayette, Indiana last week, where they marked the start of production of Camrys at the Subaru plant. That Subaru plant was half empty until Toyota came in, put in $230 million, and began building Camrys there. Now they're adding 1,000 extra jobs. I mean, it depends on your point of view. If you think the American auto industry should only be General Motors, Ford, and Chrysler, of course Chrysler's owned by a German company, then I guess it's a bad omen. If you want people investing in the United States and hiring Americans and building cars in the United States, then I think people could see this as a positive. I mean, Toyota is a very profitable company, and the people who go to work for Toyota seem to be pretty happy working there. General Motors lost $10.6 billion in 2005, $2 billion last year. It isn't back to profitability yet in the United States. So any investment that they make may not be as solid as an investment Toyota makes. I mean, it's an issue that can definitely be debated, and it does go to the future of the American auto industry.
Yeah, and I certainly wasn't saying that I personally think it's a bad omen, but that people in Janesville at the GM plant might be wondering what this means for them.
Well, I think it depends on the model mix, and you know, Janesville is known has been successful for years building big SUVs and big vehicles. Well, now gas prices are $3 a gallon and more. I mean, I don't think that it's anything to do with Toyota. It has everything to do with what General Motors thinks the future of the car market will be.
Yeah. Let's take some calls. Becky in Verona, hi, you're on the air.
Hi, how are you?
Good.
My husband drives a Prius, I drive a Prius, and my son drives a Prius. But I called because I'm from New Jersey, and when I lived there, I worked in a garment industry, and I was in a sewing union for 20 years. I moved to Kentucky to go to college, and after I got out, I did work for Toyota in two of the plants they have in Bardstown and Litchfield. And they don't have unions, of course, in the Toyota plant. But I wanted to say that when you work for Toyota, it's a fantastic job. It's a fantastic place to work. The benefits are great. The management is great. I can see this as a debate more between from a union perspective, because the unions are up in arms because, of course, all these Toyota plants aren't unionized. So that's where I see the big debate. But I'll tell you what, I'd buy another Toyota in a heartbeat. I get 50 miles per gallon in my Prius, and I love it.
That's very interesting to hear. It's really interesting that you've had both the East Coast and the Midwest experience there.
Yeah, talk a little bit more about union versus non-union. Does that play into this?
Well, there's a couple things. First of all, in Japan, Toyota's always had unions, so they're used to working with unions in their home market. Here in the United States, their first factory actually is still open. It's represented by the UAW. It's called NUMMI out in Fremont, California. So they have an experience working with the UAW here in the United States. None of their factories in the United States and Canada are unionized. The way that this has gone about is Toyota's opened the factories and kind of sat back and waited to see if the UAW or the CAW would come in and organize it. Now, it depends on what goes on with the organizing drives. I mean, Toyota has... There have been efforts both at the plant in Canada and in the Georgetown factory in Kentucky to organize the UAW, and each time Toyota's been able to defeat those efforts. So it's, you know, the Georgetown plant has been open almost 20 years now. The plant up in Canada, I think, is about 10 years old now. And so there's certainly been an opportunity for the UAW. They are trying to organize the plant in Georgetown. They have an office just down the street from the plant. So there is a very active effort going on. But on the other hand, they now are going up against 20 years of Toyota history, and people are used to working without a union. I think they look at what goes on with General Motors and Ford and Chrysler cutting jobs and kind of wonder, what can the UAW get us that we don't already have?
Yeah. Well, Becky and her family are certainly contributing to the good Prius sales. Did I hear you talking on All Things Considered with Robert Siegel this week about this story, but also the Prius, that is one of the vehicles that Toyota does manufacture
in Japan?
In Japan, yeah.
Yes, and it's very interesting because even as Toyota sales grow in the United States, their imports from Japan have actually grown the last 3 years. And it's sort of like, as Toyota just gets more successful in general, they're using Japan as a center of production and then expanding their local production in the markets where they do business. But it's kind of ironic that their imports are going up as their American production is going up. And I guess it just points to the fact that, you know, people want to buy Toyotas.
Mm. Thank you, Becky. Angela in Racine is next. Hi, you're on the air.
Hi, I just wanted to comment that I myself drive a Corolla, and my husband just bought the Toyota-produced Scion.
Oh, yeah.
And, yeah, to be fair, we looked around. We thought, let's just see what else is out there besides the Toyotas, because we both love the Toyotas. And nothing could compare as far as the price mixed with the gas mileage.
That's interesting. The Scion, for people who don't know, they're very stylish vehicles. You're allowed to choose the options that you want. They're really kind of aimed at the youngest buyers in the industry who want the chance to just pick everything that goes on their car. Now, Scions aren't the cheapest cars on the market. You probably paid, what, somewhere around 20,000.
Well, we got the XA, and that was about 14,500.
You got a bargain then, I guess.
Yeah.
But you could have bought something like a Hyundai or a Kia, or there's a small General Motors car called the Cobalt. I mean, did you go and look at any of those?
We did look at those smaller cars, but then it came, when it comes to the reliability, we just know we can count on the Toyotas.
That's really interesting. The only other make that I've had, actually, well, I had a Honda, which was very reliable. Then I had a Volkswagen, and I had all kinds of problems with my Volkswagen in the first 2 years of owning it, and then I went back to Toyota. I'm sort of a bit like you in that I do get used to the reliability, and you don't really want to go anywhere else.
Thank you, Angela. Dennis in Sister Bay is with us now. Hi, Dennis.
Hi. Over the 30 years of my career as a doctor in a clinic that was located close to two major Ford plants, an assembly plant and a stamping plant, I heard many stories from Ford workers that made me concerned about the systemic problems in those particular plants. I don't know if it speaks to what was going on with all of their plants, but so many of the things I heard were so egregious in terms of managerial mistakes, worker complaints that weren't addressed. Just to point out one that I heard more recently was the fact that a gentleman who worked in the tow motor and forklift department talked about how those vehicles were operated with batteries, and batteries cost $5,000 each. They required a 24-hour charge cycle, and the workers would simply pull them off the chargers prematurely after 8-10 hours, and they were running out of batteries. They had to replace these batteries on ad infinitum, and it just seemed to me that we were doing a lot of things that is American manufacturing to allow Toyota to leapfrog ahead of us.
Was that down towards Chicago or over by
Chicago Heights stamping plant and the Riverdale assembly plant?
I've been in both those places, actually. I think one of the things that I wrote about in The End of Detroit is the fact that Detroit companies in general had what I call sort of the good enough syndrome, that, they would embrace quality circles, they would embrace, continuous improvement, and they'd do it for a while, and they'd say, okay, that's good enough, and they would go on to the next thing or the next fad in the industry, and I really don't ever think they addressed their systemic problems or ever really created the kind of production system that Toyota has, and I think that obviously everyone is examining Detroit and what went wrong. And I believe that the one thing about Toyota is Toyota's got a process, and the process doesn't change, whereas with GM, Ford, and Chrysler, it's sometimes been the flavor of the month, and they just try this. Maybe it doesn't work, maybe it does work, and then they go on to the next thing.
We're talking with Micheline Maynard. She is the Detroit Bureau Chief for the New York Times. She writes about the automobile industry and the airline industry. We're talking about the news this week that Toyota is number one in worldwide auto sales for the first quarter of this year, beating GM for the very first time. Talking about what this means and what it means for the future, too. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Joy Cardine. Happy to have you along on this Friday, April the 27th. It's 7:36. Our spring pledge drive starts on May 3rd, but your online pledge before the drive may help shorten the drive. Well, it will help shorten the drive because this is going to be one of those drives where when we reach the goal, we stop asking for your contribution. So when the goal is reached, the drive will end. And if we raise lots of money online before the drive starts, that's going to shorten the drive. It could even result in the drive not even starting at all. The goal is $275,000 for our May pledge drive. Right now, online, and we just started doing this, $10,000 raised toward that goal. So go online if you're inclined to pledge, WPR.org, and you can check out our progress toward the goal. We are talking this hour about the news that Toyota has surpassed General Motors in worldwide car sales for the first quarter of this year. Talking with a guest about what this means and why this happened, she is Micheline Maynard, the Detroit Bureau Chief for the New York Times. She's a lecturer on the global auto industry at the University of Michigan, the author of a number of books on the auto industry. Her latest, The End of Detroit, How the Big Three Lost Their Grip on the American Car Market. We welcome your thoughts and questions for her about this. 1-800-642-1234 in Madison, 263-1890. We go next to Mark in McHenry, Illinois. Hi, you're on the air.
Hi, Joy and Micheline. I do have a couple of quick questions. Speaking as a Mustang driver who will never drive anything but the choice between GM and Toyota is not my issue. But my question is, does it matter if GM is the number one car company in the world? If it does come up with models that people want to buy and it achieves sustainable profitability, there's always going to be somebody who's number one. But there can be many others who are not in number one and yet still are profitable, well-run companies. So I guess long-term, is it just a matter of national pride, or does it even matter? And then my second question is, what about the huge legacy costs that that the American auto companies are facing with their pension programs and that sort of thing? Isn't that a huge drag that ultimately could take them down?
Those are both very good comments, and I definitely agree with you in the first one. I mean, for years, Toyota has been the world's strongest car maker. They have more than $46 billion in cash. They earned about $12.6 billion last year, when 2 years ago when General Motors was losing about that same amount of money. So essentially, if you think about it, there's a $25 billion spread at the time between where General Motors was and where Toyota was. I mean, if General Motors could be number two and be as successful, as profitable, have as loyal customers as Toyota, I think that would be an enormous achievement for General Motors. The fact is they haven't been consistently profitable. They've been eliminating jobs. They've lost market share every year since about, and their latest market share losses go on since 2002, but they've really been in a market share decline for a couple of decades now. So, you know, if they could be what Toyota was when Toyota was number two, I think that would be terrific for General Motors. The second issue on legacy costs, I mean, I always say that there are two signatures on every UAW contract, and management agreed to pay health care, they agreed to pay pensions, they provided benefits to the union back in the years when they thought they could afford them. And in fact, during the 1990s, when SUV sales were at their peak, we didn't hear much about legacy costs because the companies were profitable and they could afford them. Now they're not profitable, and now they talk about legacy costs. Well, you know, they've gone to the president to talk about this issue, and the response they got from the White House was basically, you got yourselves into this, you need to come up with a solution. I mean, I think long-term, the solution for the country might have to be national health care, but short-term, you know, they're like any other business in the country. They sign labor contracts, and it's kind of up to them to live with them.
Thank you, Mark. Paul in Toma is with us next. Hi, Paul.
Hi. We have a Honda Insight, which we bought from Honda Motor Works at half the price of the new Insight. Ours is a 2001. Our daughter has a 2000 Honda Insight, which she also bought from Honda Motor Works at half the price of a new one. Our car, the maximum mileage I've gotten is 96.7 miles per gallon for a short distance, and often we get better than 70 miles per gallon. In going from Toma to Oshkosh, my son got 74.4 miles per gallon. As far as speed is concerned, yeah, I've been able to get 105 miles per hour. I saw that on the speedometer shortly ago, and I hear they will
do 105.
Yes, and I hear they will do 112. Whenever we need more power, we just go down to the next lower gear. Our other car is a 99 Chevy Malibu, which we only get 30 miles per gallon with, but we have that for when we need more than to people in the car. We will not go back to GM for a car until they come up with something that is more fuel efficient. We think our primary concern right now is reducing our oil dependence. And if all of us concentrate on being able to do that, we will really be helping the United States to come out better in that respect. And also, everyone needs to see the video who killed the electric car. Thank you very much.
Well, thank you for calling. So it's got a Malibu and a Honda Insight.
Right. That's pretty amazing. I mean, you hear stories about mileage like that. I mean, I think there's two things with hybrid electric vehicles. First of all, if you live on a farm in Wisconsin, they might not be that practical. I mean, these are really city cars. And, in fact, they get better mileage in the city than they do on the freeway. But the other issue is people aren't just buying them for the gas mileage. They're buying them because the emissions are they're not zero emission vehicles, but the emissions are almost nothing. And people kind of feel like they're making an effort for sustainability, for the environment. And I think that's one of the issues. I write this in my book that, you know, first of all, Detroit missed sort of the curiosity factor, and they missed this feeling that people wanted to do something. And you know, I wrote my book when $3 a gallon gasoline was only happening in California. Now we have $3 a gallon gasoline almost everywhere in the country, and it's headed towards $4 on the coast. So I really think that the skepticism over hybrids the last couple of years is going to go away, and people are going to be scrambling to find whatever they can find that gets better gasoline mileage.
Thank you very much, Paul. And slow down. Robert in Kenosha, hi, you're on the air.
Good morning. First of all, it's a privilege to talk to Ms. Maynard. I've heard her on other shows, and she's a wonderful analyst. And But I want to say that I am a pro-union, and I live in Kenosha. I bought American Motors cars, and I buy Chrysler cars. And, yes, in the past, there were some bad cars. But the quality has increased tremendously. I don't have any problems with the cars that I drive now. And I also feel, as a member of the community, I want to pay the legacy costs for the people who are retired in our area. I think that's part of living in a community. And I'd like to hear her comments on that.
Well, I think that's terrific. And I actually have been to the Kenosha, I guess it was just after Chrysler bought AMC, and I was there, and Lee Iacocca was there. So maybe that gives away my age, but it also shows how long that plant's been part of the community there. But let me make a couple of points. First of all, I mean, my mom is a UAW retiree. She actually worked at Eastern Michigan University, and they organized the clerical and administrative personnel there. So she has fully paid health care. You know, thank God for that, because I'm so grateful not to have that weighing on my mind as she ages. I think that's an interesting comment that he's willing to pay the legacy cost, willing to pay for that. I think what's happening with Detroit vehicles is, by and large, their quality has improved, but that the standard is still set by the Japanese. And if you look at Consumer Reports, you know, the 10 most recommended vehicles that they offer, none of them are built by Detroit companies. I think, you know, the problem Detroit has is that there's so many people with long memories of past quality, and to them, the quality now is just terrific. But to people who buy Toyotas and Hondas, you know, they're used to a higher standard, and they won't go back. They won't, or maybe they never owned Detroit vehicles in the first place. And so I think long memories both help and hurt the Detroit car makers.
We are talking about the news this week that Toyota surpassed GM in worldwide car sales during the first quarter of this year for the first time ever, bumping GM out of that number one top spot. We're wondering why this happened and what it means, and welcoming your questions for our guest, Micheline Maynard, Detroit Bureau Chief for the New York Times. 1-800-642-1234 in Madison, 263-1890. She is the author of a number of books on the auto industry. Her most recent is The End of Detroit, How the Big Three Lost Their Grip on the American Car Market. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network. Good to have you with us on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. It's 12 minutes before 8 o'clock on this Friday, April the 27th. Coming up after 8, it's our Friday Week in Review. We will welcome in Ed Garvey and Dave Blaska to talk with you about the top political news stories of the week, coming up after 8. Our next caller for Micheline Maynard is Butch in Toma. Hi, you're on the air.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. I was wondering what the pay structure is in Toyota compared to the big three, and as far as insurance and then that type of package. I'll take my answer off the air. Thank you.
Sure. Well, at the Georgetown factory, which was their first plant in the United States, UAW members make about $28 an hour before things like COLA, cost of living, and other additions to their salary. Workers at Georgetown make about $25 an hour. They don't have the traditional pension plans that the UAW has, although they do have them at Honda, which I think is very interesting. They do have the traditional kind of pension plans. Workers at Toyota have a profit-sharing plan. They have a 401k plan. They have medical insurance. What Toyota is doing at its newer plants, actually, it's been going deeper into the South, and because wages tend to be less in the South, they aren't paying as much as they're paying up north. For example, the starting wage in San Antonio is about $14 an hour, and interestingly enough, they've added a health care clinic right on the site of the San Antonio plant. So if you get sick, you don't go to the hospital, you don't go home, you go to the clinic, and it's also preventive medicine. So, for example, at their plant in Alabama, I visited there a couple of years ago. When you hire into the plant, you don't set foot on the factory floor for 6 months. You go through training. You go to 2 hours worth of cardio and working with weights and other physical strengthening a day until you're ready to set foot on the factory floor. So what they're heavily into is, first of all, hiring workers who are able to do the work. Second of all, having them stay healthy, and third, if they get sick, you know, they look after their workers. It sounds a little bit like a throwback to the Pullman days of, you know, the early 20th century in Chicago, but I think it's very interesting that the efforts that they're going to sort of keep a monitor on their employees' health.
Here's an email from Raleigh in New Berlin. The feeling I get, he writes, is that Toyota's goal is to make its customers satisfied. It seems that GM's goal is to make billionaires of its top executives. What do you think?
That's very interesting. I mean, I've always had the suspicion with the Detroit companies that, you know, executives spend as much time managing their careers as they do managing the company. And I think one of the reasons for that is that these companies were so huge and complex, it was very hard to get to a level where you had the authority without climbing a lot. And I think at the what's happened with Toyota and the others is that they give authority to people right on the factory floor. So the issue of I have to climb the company to get any power goes away. I do think that Honda and Toyota and some of the other good Japanese and Korean-German companies are much more focused on the customer. It's sort of like they're listening to the customer, and the Detroit companies have always been telling the customer what they needed.
Mm. And now we go to Greg in Watertown. Hi, you're on the air.
Good morning. Say, I'd like to point out that what we're kind of talking about here and beating around the bushes, talking about systems thinking. 10 or 15 years ago, Edward Deming, the systems thinker, brought his concepts of management to the automakers here in the U.S., and they turned him down flatly. He then went over to Japan, where he was embraced wholeheartedly. And I think that with the systems thinking management style, we're incorporating into the management system a feedback loop, continuous improvement, long-term holistic visioning. And here in the United States, we have this myopic, mechanistic view of next quarter's return on investment. And everything is so short-sighted, and everybody's in their little drill holes and not talking to one another. And again, over in Japan, we have people of all different levels of management and all different auspices of society talking to one another, trying to figure out the concerns of each other, trying to work in a participatory, inclusive process. And we really need to adopt this in our country soon, or we're going to see these trends continue.
Well, I think you're right about that. I mean, first of all, Dr. Deming, I actually had the honor of being able to study with him when I was at Columbia University. He was great friends with one of my professors, and it was sort of the end of his life, but he still was as brilliant as he was back in the 50s when he went to Japan and helped the Japanese reconstruct their auto industry. And I'm a big believer in, you know, I would call it manufacturing process, but just the whole idea that you have something that you build your company around that you don't change every 6 months to a year. And I think that's been one of the problems that GM and the other Detroit companies have had, is that they never really had anything to build their companies around. It was sort of at the whim of senior management, whereas the Toyota production system and the Honda way don't change. It doesn't matter whether it's Mr. Okuda, Mr. Cho, or Mr. Watanabe running Toyota. Toyota stays the same, and the people kind of come in and go out. And that level of consistency, I mean, it's like Nordstrom's or Apple or some of the great companies in this country, Southwest Airlines, they don't change. The people embrace that, and that, I think, shows up in their products.
Yeah. So will this trend continue, as Greg wondered?
Well, what I had said in the book that I thought by 2010 Toyota would become the world's biggest car maker, and that the Detroit companies and foreign automakers would split the American market 50-50. Well, there was a month during late last year, I believe, when the Detroit companies fell to 50.6% of the American car market, and I really think we're coming very close to the day when, you know, we could even see more foreign sales in the United States than we do sales from Detroit companies.
Tom in Milwaukee is with us now. Hi, Tom.
Hi, how are you?
Good.
I just wanted to chime in on the type of company Toyota is. I've had the good fortune to work for a division of Toyota, my company does, and was able to go to some of their dealer meetings, and just the way they approach the entire market is so phenomenal. They do a lot of product research. They know where their competition is coming from. But like what a lot of people have said, is their biggest thing is they listen to their customers, and they get put into their cars what their customers want and build this in from the very structure of the lowest person on the factory floor to all the way through to the highest part of management. And I think that is contributing to their success. And I, for one, who drove Chryslers almost all my life, a few years turned to Toyota. I drive a Lexus now. I can say I probably will never go back.
Well, that's very interesting to hear you say. You know, I was at Lafayette last week, as I mentioned, and I was speaking with Steve St. Angelo, who's the manager of the Georgetown plant, and he had sent a team over to help the folks at Subaru start production of Camrys. And he said to, you know, I thought, oh, here's Toyota teaching Subaru how to build cars. And he said to me, I told my guys, I want you to take 10 ideas back from here to Georgetown, and I want to see you implement them. I mean, they don't consider that they're the experts. They consider that they're always in this learning mode. And I boy, is that different from the culture in Detroit. I mean, the culture in Detroit was, we'll tell you what you want. We'll give you the cars you want to buy. And in Toyota, it's a very, very different attitude. It's tell us what you need, and we'll give it to you.
Yes.
And look at how much money they've made. I mean, I always think that people say, oh, you know, Toyota's are bland, and Toyotas are not the Mustangs and the Corvettes and the cars of Detroit's glory days. But, you know, look at the money that they make, and look at the number of satisfied customers that they have.
That's interesting. We did just get an email from Dave, I'm not sure where, who kind of made the same point. He owns a Buick, and he says, the problem I see is this. GM designs a good car, but then puts the driver into it later. He says it's well built, but it had all sorts of design flaws, and, you know, he had to look into the passenger's rear view mirror by leaning into the passenger seat and that sort of thing. So he had some complaints. Yeah. David in Boulder Junction, hi, you're on the air.
Good morning. What a great program. Mm-hmm. I could this program could go on for 3 hours, but I just
yeah.
I have a theory, and I want to one theory, and I wanted to hear your expert's opinion. I'll make my comment and then take my listen to her off the air. I think until probably the last 5 or 10 years, when the big automakers here got really serious about quality, I think prior to that, they were just selling financing. And they got away from the vision of building cars. And When you're selling financing, it was just a commodity. It didn't matter whether it was cars or soybeans or corn.
Yeah. You know, we only have a minute to go. I'm so sorry to cut it short. Micheline Maynard, is that what happened?
Well, the financing operations of both General Motors and Ford and to some extent Chrysler have provided with a lot of their profits over the last 10 years, such as they were. And so, you know, they have to sell cars to sell financing, but I think the way they were making money was on their financial operations.
It has been a real pleasure. I wish we could go longer. Lots of callers still want to talk with you. Thank you so much for being with us.
My pleasure. And if people want to reach me at any time, please go to newyorktimes.com, nytimes.com. If you do search for my name, you can click on it and send me an email.
Yeah, thanks a lot.
My pleasure.
Micheline Maynard, Detroit Bureau Chief for the New York Times, lecturer on the global auto industry at the University of Michigan. Author of a number of books, most recently The End of Detroit, How the Big Three Lost Their Grip on the American Car Market. Thanks to Karen Prager for producing this hour, and thank you for listening. I hope you stay tuned. There's much more to come. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.